Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. This summer on In the Moment, we're dedicating the Monday noon hour to a few of our favorite authors and a few of our favorite books. And today we welcome Norma Wilson and Jerry Wilson. Norma Wilson taught at the University of South Dakota for 27 years before retiring in 2005. Her books include The Nature of Native American Poetry, Rivers, Wings, and Sky, and her latest poetry collection, Frog Creek Road. Jerry Wilson served as managing editor for South Dakota Magazine, and now he devotes himself to books that explore the natural world and fiction that reimagines history and contemporary life. His latest book is Eden to Orizaba. Norma and Jerry live in rural southeast South Dakota in a geosolar house they built in the early 1980s, and they're joining us today in the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls Studios. Norma and Jerry, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate you making the trip to Sioux Falls to spend the hour with us.
We appreciate being invited.
Thank you, Laura. It's our pleasure.
And I want to start, Norma, with this new book, Frog Creek Road, because this is your latest poetry collection. Tell us a little bit about finding a home for these poems. Many have been in publications and then now in this collection.
That's right. I think this collection of poems has been written over a period of 36 years.
Wow.
So that's a long time. And the poems have been published in various places, including South Dakota Magazine. I really appreciate having a publisher here in Sioux Falls with Scurfpy Publishing, Steve Boynt, who appreciates poetry about this area.
Yeah.
And so I put them all together because I realized, particularly in writing Rivers, Wings, and Sky, which is about the southeastern corner of South Dakota and the ecosystem in that area, how much I appreciated living in my own place. In fact, it wasn't the first time I'd realized that, because, you know, having lived there, having built the house and raised our two children there, it's just, I'm part of the place, and it's part of me, and I belong to it. And so I ended up writing a seasonal book. Begins in winter, and it goes through the season of spring, summer, and then into fall. And I realized at first I was dividing it into different parts, and then I thought, no, that's not the way it happens. It's just the seasons flow. And so that's what the poems do. I know that probably in future books I'll come back to my home, but this is the one that's really about this place.
Yeah.
That I love to live there and come back when I've traveled somewhere else.
And it's, talk a little, if you will, about how important it is. You mentioned Scurfpy and just the fact that there is publishing here, from here, that's getting published here. Without that might not exist in the same way. It would be a great loss. How valuable is it to have the poetry of this place be published from this place? Yeah.
Yeah. Why are so many stories, novels, poems set in New York City? Well, that's where the publishers are. And I think that's the idea. So if we don't have publishers here, it's hard to find an audience. Not that we can't write, and I'm hoping that some of these poems, I mean, I know that they reach beyond
right. Just
the place where I live, because I have attachments, connections to other places. In fact, I was born in Tennessee, I lived in Oklahoma for quite some time too before coming here. But I feel that to be really aware of the world and understand it, there's no better way to learn than through travel. So I love to travel as well. And yet, why? I mean, I'm not sure why, you know, the ordinary life in this place isn't more interesting to people, because it's a very special place where I live. Mm-hmm. There's more of the natural world left on our plates than in much of the United States. In fact, when Jerry and I travel to other places, when we come back home, Jerry's always saying, well, I'm seeing more wild animals here than I've seen on our whole trip. And that'll be as we're going up the hill toward our house, all the deer are appearing. And then there's a few raccoons and turkeys coming out. So, you know, it's a very special place. I want to write about it. And thank goodness there's a publisher. There are more than one publisher interested in this. But we're very lucky to have one in Sioux Falls. It's easier to promote your books if the publisher is right here, because you've got a comrade who's helping.
Right. I'm hoping you might read one of the poems from this new collection, Frog Creek Road. And I'm looking at page 22, a poem called Making Our Home on the Prairie, because I mentioned the house that you both live in and how you built this in the early 80s. And this is a little something that sort of helps put us all in that place. It's very, very specific. And yet it's very universal at the same time, which good poetry is.
Sure, I'll read this poem. Making Our Home on the Prairie. After searching in all directions for a solar building site, we find a south-facing hill on Frog Creek Road for sale. I love at first sight the view of Jerry gazing at the vast surrounding prairie and all that I survey. Exploring the 40, we find a seasonal creek, a pond and spring, wild plum, sumac, walnut, elm, mulberry, box elder, hackberry, and chokecherry trees, but no trees to shelter our house from wind and snow. We buy the land in a tractor, and early that spring, Jerry plows a crescent of earth above our home site, and we plant 1,000 saplings in 7 rows to crown our hill. Pine, honeysuckle, ash, Russian olive, maple, locust, and lilac. It rains until late May. Impatiently, we prepare. And as soon as the earth is dry, our burrow is dug and building begins. Each morning, we load the pickup with tools, a stack of diapers, our toddler, a pot of soup, and our dog Bounce. We work until noon, take a sandwich break, then I lie down in the tent, coaxing Walt to take a nap. One day, as we duck inside, he says, "Mousy." 2 mice scurry out of our tent. Walt is too excited to fall asleep, so we walk through the grasses to look for them.
Norma Wilson reading from Frog Creek Road. And Jerry, I want to bring you into the conversation because you too have written about this place that you live and you too have written about the seasons as they change. Tell us what for you is so captivating about this little spot in South Dakota that really is a metaphor for so much more about our planet.
Yeah, and again, this is probably kind of a historic occurrence that Scurfpea Publishing here in Sioux Falls, Steve Boynt, published both of these books, and they're similar in some ways in that they're both a seasonal book going through a calendar year, except that mine is prose, Norma's is poetry. I have always been a keen observer of nature and a lover of all things natural. So this place has always been special to me, but then over the years, the 36 or 7 years that we've lived there, we've had opportunities to buy some adjacent land so that now we have a substantial piece of property along the Missouri River Bluff. And we have been working bit by bit over about the last quarter century to restore native prairie on all of the flatter lands. Much of it is hilly and wooded and deep ravines and water, but we now have native prairie restored to most of the open land. So it's once again resembling the prairie that the settlers might have found when they first arrived. Can't ever be complete because too many species have been lost there are too many invaders, but it's a beautiful thing to see, and to see the full-scale ecosystem of mammals and birds that have evolved with this reinvigorated prairie, and that's one of the things that I love most.
I'm hoping you might read from Seasons of the Coyote. This is a year on the Prairie Bluff, and as we're recording this, the week of the 4th of July, and people are getting ready for their own Independence Day rituals, you spent some time really thinking about natural land and history and the future. So would you read a little bit from that section of this book, please?
Sure. So this is the July 4th entry, and it's called Independence Day, Protecting Natural Land. Today is Independence Day, a day when Americans celebrate freedom from the tyranny of foreign rule. We conveniently forget that we are also a nation built by invaders, by non-natives on this land. Here in southeastern South Dakota, that invasion began when white settlers displaced the Yankton Sioux, beginning in 1859 and rapidly accelerating with the passage of the Homestead Act 3 years later. Homesteaders brought vigor and hard work and many admirable values and skills to the land they possessed, but they also brought non-native seeds, sometimes inappropriate land use, and in some cases, disregard for both the peoples they dispossessed and for the long-term needs of the land they claimed. A century and a half later, little is left that might remind us of the rich cultural and natural world they inherited. Given the tiny fraction of native prairie that remains, prairie is perhaps the most degraded ecosystem in North America. Norma and I and our children are well aware of how blessed our lives have been in our country and on this scrap of prairie bluff and woods, where remnants of that natural world remain and where we have had the opportunity to work at restoring some of what was lost. After 35 years of walking trails, listening to birds, and sitting in meditation at the spring, I have not stopped asking myself, what did I do to deserve this? Yes, we lived frugally and saved money so that when the opportunity to buy land arose, we could act. Yes, we actively pursued opportunities that make things happen as they did. And yes, we have invested thousands of hours of labor building our home, rescuing land from the encroachment of invasive grasses, weeds, and cedar trees, and to the best of our abilities, rehabilitating abused soil through the restoration of native grasses and forbs. But there was also a huge element of good fortune. More than once, we were simply in the right place at the right time. But the work continues. Every year we make the rounds, cutting down young cedars that have sprung from seeds deposited by female cedars I removed years ago. Many springs we have gathered friends to burn selected meadows to enhance and maintain the prairie's health. Every June I walk the prairie with a sweep net, gathering leafy spurge-eating flea beetles to release in yet another area threatened by the persistent weed. Every July we scour the prairies and woods, loppers or hoe in hand, removing other invaders that refuse to die. We are under no illusion that our land has been or could be restored to its truly natural condition. We are aware that our work has, to a large extent, been an artificial exercise. It is the paradox of conservation that the best human efforts to truly restore natural conditions will not be adequate. We simply have done what we could do as we had the insight and energy to act. But for how much longer can we wield these tools, climb prairie hills, and perform these tasks? If we are fortunate and health holds out, perhaps a decade or two, or perhaps not. These days, my thankful meditations are often clouded by these questions. Indeed, I am sometimes gripped by anxiety when I ask myself, who will carry on these vital responsibilities when we cannot? I find no obvious answer. Perhaps these feelings are not so different from those experienced by women and men who have invested in their lives in building institutions or even successful businesses. Certainly. I understand the angst of aging farmers who have carefully nurtured their land in the midst of an agribusiness revolution that has turned every farm around them into a profit-driven sea of monoculture, land that in many cases is managed by someone who neither owns nor lives upon the land, but is driven solely by the amount of profit that can be squeezed from this year's crop of corn and beans. And yet, our blessing and our commitment are different. Norma and I have been entrusted with what is an increasingly rare island of diversity, an irregular swath of water, woods, and prairie hills that has grown in health while most surrounding land has been neglected, abused, or turned into a medium for the annual injection of chemicals and engineered seeds. So what to do?
Jerry Wilson reading from his book, Seasons of the Coyote. So what to do? Do you have an answer as you lay out sort of, you know, the nuances of the problem so eloquently?
Well, we have a longtime friend named John Davidson, a retired environmental law professor from the University of South Dakota, who years ago founded the Northern Prairies Land Trust. And for many years, we discussed the possibility of putting our land into a conservation easement. And so on about the 4th of July, a few years back, we did execute such an agreement. So all of our property is now in a perpetual conservation easement so that when we are no longer able to take care of it, it is legally protected from inappropriate development. So the legal document spells out what can't be done there, what can't happen there, but there is no way to determine from beyond the grave what must be done, and that's the dilemma, is, you know, who will carry on the necessary work to maintain this property in as near natural condition as possible. That's an unanswered question.
It seems as if a lot of what both of you write is part of the message for the future of what must be done, from noticing to some of the behavior and the work that you do mm-hmm. on the land, even from a political standpoint, your thoughts on what should be done, what must right. be done. We are with Norma and Jerry Wilson today. We'll take a break and we'll be back on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the SCPB Sioux Falls studios in the Leo P. Flynn Gallery. And my guests for today's Brown Bag Book Club, Jerry Wilson and Norma Wilson. Thank you so much again for being here. And Norma, we'd like to go back to Frog Creek Road and see if you could read a little more for us. And one of the things that I found so powerful was the foreword of the book by David Allen Evans, our former South Dakota poet laureate, and the introduction to the book, and he really made a comparison to Mary Oliver and the connection that she had with nature. And one of the things I love about that comparison is it's not just a poetry comparison, but it's sort of a, you know, when I think of Mary Oliver, I think of her in the woods sort of gathering mushrooms. And as I read this book, you know, here you are, you know, as a little wet duck underneath, you know, you're crawling around on the land, and you're sort of doing some of those things that are, not only are you writing about nature, but you're part of it in the mud, in the dirt, in the rain, with the creatures. Do you like that comparison?
I love it. I really appreciated Dave's introduction to my book. I mean, his response to it. I felt so honored.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I'm on page 37, Awake with the Wildflowers, and I think this is a great poem to sort of illustrate that comparison a little bit, if you would mind reading Awake with Wildflowers for us.
Awake with Wildflowers. Jerry and Walter have gone to bed, but I am awake with wildflowers I found in the ditch today when I went out with a staple gun to reattach the stop spraying sign someone or the wind had ripped away. Though I went on behalf of the Forbes, I took the hoe also to chop down thistles. Along the way, I made a wild bouquet of meadow rose, western wallflower, snow on the mountain, bracted spiderwort, blue lettuce, creeping jenny, vervain, pale purple coneflower, and prairie milkweed. I chopped down all the wavy leaf thistles I found, but kept one fragrant and large magenta blossom. Like the poisonous purple flower in Rappaccini's Daughter, for my bouquet. While brushing my hair tonight, I see in the eye of my mind the girl inside me budding like a meadow rose on the prairie that will be her home. And of course, that poem was written during the time I was pregnant with Laura, and that first summer when we were working on the place and building the house, and I would go out and chop thistles, but I had to admit that I thought the blossom of the wavy leaf thistle was rather beautiful. And I thought, I was, of course, preparing to teach that fall. I taught American literature in the fall, and I taught the first part in which one of my favorite stories was Hawthorne's Rappaccini's Daughter. So that came into the poem, too.
How much has living where you live, not only your actual home with Jerry, but in South Dakota, in Southeast South Dakota, how has that changed who you are as a writer and what you write about?
That's a good question. I know that I don't know if you've ever seen my first book, Wild Iris, but that was written in Oklahoma. And, you know, I had been writing poetry for probably about a year when I started writing the poems for that book. And I found, you know, that I just started writing poetry. I mean, I didn't intend to write a book at first, but my relatives came into that book. I had a section of the book called Tennessee Talk, and I had my grandparents in there and where they lived, the farm, and the landscape, and my mother and father, and my brother and sister. And then another section of the book was Oklahoma, and where I was living at that time. I called that part Seeing the World, and the truth beyond the moment, and those who made me see it. I was learning. I was seeing more of the world. And I think that all those things are in this book, too. I think that somewhat like, I feel like I'm doing, in a way, what Walt Whitman did. He just wrote one book, Leaves of Grass, but he had all these parts for it. And so I feel like every book is related to every other book that I write, of poetry in particular. And then the book, the nonfiction book, The Nature of Native American Poetry, that certainly is related, because I wanted to learn more from Native Americans. That's why I wrote my dissertation on Native American poetry. The spirit of place in Native American poetry was the title of my dissertation. And I wrote about the way that Native Americans regarded themselves as belonging to place rather than the place belonging to them. And so, you know, I think that my books are all related in a sense, and my writing has come out of that. As a child in Tennessee, I would sit on the grass and I would think, where was I before I was born? I thought, who was I and where was I? And, you know, I thought there was this some kind of relationship I had to the place.
Yeah. So. And now we will have our first U.S. Poet Laureate who is a Native American poet.
Yes.
That's a huge... that's a huge announcement, really.
Yes,
made.
I was very excited about that she was... and she was one of the poets I featured in my book, The Nature of Native American Poetry, and I was able to help bring her to South Dakota with her band, Poetic Justice. It was so much fun. We really enjoyed having her here. And she's originally from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So I'd known about her work for a long time. In fact, I met her in 1977 before I moved to South Dakota in 78. I met her in New Mexico. She was living there then. And I'd gone there to interview Leslie Marmon Silko, who was teaching at the University of New Mexico, and it turned out that she was going to have Joy Harjo reading poetry in her class that day, so she invited me to come, and that's where I first became acquainted with Joy's poetry.
Interesting. Let's keep talking about place, but let's expand that, because as we talk about place, we talk about people. And Jerry, let's transition to Eden to Orizaba, because this is fiction. Mm-hmm. Now we're in your fictional world. And there are ties in this book to the city of Sioux Falls in South Dakota, because some of the characters have connections there. But this is really a book about the other and seeing one another for more than our first impression. Tell us a little bit about what inspired this book, because it becomes more and more relevant mm-hmm. in 2019 as we deal with issues of immigration and issues along the southern border
right.
of separation and violence and despair, really.
Well, for most of my adult life, I've considered Mexico my other country, my second country. Traveled there 30 times at least, all over the country. I love the country and the people, and I am distressed by the crises at the border, but also the crises behind it, the poverty and violence and so on that are driving the immigration, and by our government's response to it or failure to respond adequately. And so two or three years ago, I decided to go to a particular part of Mexico to do some exploring. Just below Mexico's highest peak, 18,600 foot Orizaba, southeast of Mexico City, I learned that there is a place where after NAFTA, the Smithfield Foods Corporation sort of dumped a million pigs on unsuspecting villagers. And exactly 10 years ago now, in 2009, that's where the global swine flu epidemic began. So I particularly wanted to investigate that, and I think with my fiction, it usually begins with investigating the historical reality, and then I try to tell a story in a way that maybe will make that a little more real for readers. So one of the two central characters in Eden to Orizaba is Pablo, and the Eden in the title is a real place in Texas, a small town west of Austin, where one of the many contract prisons is located, and that's where Pablo was put after he was arrested for crossing the Rio Grande on his way to Sioux Falls to work, ironically, for the same corporation that has brought all the pigs to his valley. He's left his new bride behind. He's desperate to find a way to make some money, to particularly now that his sister and others are coming down sick from the swine flu that's infected the village of Victoria where they live. And so I could introduce Pablo by reading from the second chapter where we first meet him, and he has no money, so he is, as many, many other Mexicans and Central Americans have done, is riding the beast, La Bestia, which is the freight train to the border, It's a very dangerous way to get there, but if you have no money, it's kind of the only way besides walking. So I'll read that section. Pablo caught the van and the local bus to Orizaba, where he filled his backpack with provisions for the journey: tortillas, fruits, 2 cans of beans, and 1 liter of water. He figured he could refill the bottle along the way. He waited behind a rail yard warehouse. When the train rounded the bend, crouching figures disappeared, flattening themselves on boxcar roofs. The train slowed and he raced across the tracks, grabbed a ladder, and swung himself up. He climbed to the top, only to find the car covered by prone bodies. The next vehicle back held just 2. Without any calculation, he leaped across the divide to that car, the momentum of the train carrying him across the 10-foot chasm under which steel wheels screeched and ground against creaking rails. Pablo hit the flat steel roof on hands and knees, skidded and rolled, and came to rest dangerously close to the edge. He pulled himself to the center and lay panting for breath. A sharp pain seared his back. A can of beans had broken his headlong tumble. He dragged his pack off and opened it. 1 can was deeply dented and seeped juice onto his spare jeans, underwear, and shirt. The bananas were smashed flat. The oranges and avocados had fared a little better. He pulled a kerchief from his pocket and cleaned up the mess as best he could. He stood the ruptured can upright, hoping it would leak no more. Pablo now had leisure to survey his circumstances. The knot of people in the car in front of him were all facing his way, their faces contorted by what looked like fear. Glancing back, he saw why. Besides his 2 fellow riders, a 3rd had appeared and was now approaching him with a gun in his hand. "Dame el dinero," the man snarled. The gun was now at Pablo's head. "Ahora," the man shouted. "Give me your money now." Pablo reached into the pocket his mother had sewed inside his belt. Why had he kept the small roll of pesos all in one place? If only he'd stashed some in his shoe. Too late now. The man smacked Pablo's forehead with the pistol, and Pablo handed over the money. The man spat in his face, stuck the roll in his pocket, and prepared to leap to the car Pablo had vacated, the roof where 2 dozen people recoiled in terror. A pair of boys jumped from the boxcar and skidded down the embankment. The thief turned his back to spring, and without a single thought, Pablo stood and swung his backpack with all his might, striking the thug in the lower back. The robber sailed, spread-eagled, into the abyss, the pistol flying from his hand. His body glanced off the wall of the now speeding boxcar and careened screaming to where steel wheels met tracks. Pablo felt a tiny bump in the split second the body was severed and the upper half expelled in a burst of blood, body parts, the gun, and a flurry of bills scattering down the embankment. A great cheer arose from the crowded car ahead, shouts of "Gracias, amigo, gracias a Dios." Pablo sank to the steel roof. What had he done? He had just killed a man. The thought of taking another human life had never entered his head, and yet a man was surely dead and at his hand. He began to weep. A very long journey had just begun, and now he was a murderer. His money pouch was empty, even his food mostly ruined. He raised his head, and the smoky diesel wind blew the tears from his eyes. The loud commotion continued from the other car. A woman threw flowers across toward him with a shout of joy. Marigolds sailed across the abyss and scattered on the wind. Now the 2 who shared his boxcar were at his side. Boys, really, younger than him, probably not more than 16. They embraced him and joined in his tears. But then one opened a plastic bag and produced a loaf of bread. He tore it in 3 pieces and handed one to Pablo. The trio clung to the roof in gathering darkness and munched the drying bread.
Jerry Wilson reading from his book, Eden to Orizaba. Let's talk more about that after a quick break. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. My guests this hour, Jerry Wilson and Norma Wilson, many books between them. And Jerry was just reading from his fictional book, Eden to Orizaba, and we were talking a little bit about the crises along the border, what's happening in Mexico, what's happening in Central America. And I want to switch to Norma and ask you to read another poem from Frog Creek Road, because this one is called Walking at Dusk. And I'm hoping that you'll read this one, because I think it is on page 59, a really beautiful way to look at poetry, where we are, and yet broadening our viewpoint to the experience of other people, and how that all kind of is condensed into this one, you know, fairly short poetic expression.
It's kind of a meditation, I guess.
Yeah.
And one about an experience in autumn. Walking at dusk. Through grasses and cedars, I walk to hear the rill still flowing. I breathe its musky fragrance, step over and climb uphill through Indian grass and big blue stem framing a path to the sky. Sun setting colors the clouds pale salmon. Now my feet crush yellow leaves that fell from the towering cottonwoods we planted above the pond 30 years ago. Eastward, a canopy of sumacs hold blood-red clusters of berries. I pass plum, cherry, and apple trees now bare. Ascending to our house, I'm in love with autumn's colors, walking for solace, back to my house, to see, on TV, a world of people divided and maimed. Tyrants bloated with all they can consume, children starving, hiding, and forced to flee. Parents and children grieving, gun makers and sellers and shooters holding us hostage with automatic weapons aimed at our voting rights. From waste and abuse, our earth is erupting with floods, fires, and seasons out of sync. I must not be silent, must reach out and march with others for the right of all human beings to walk in peace.
That's Norma Wilson reading the poem Walking at Dusk from her new collection, Frog Creek Road. One of the things when I think about both of your work always comes to mind is as deeply in the moment of, you know, what's happening with the seasons, what's happening on your own property, the daily conversations that you have with each other is also this awareness and this deep engagement with what's happening in the rest of the world, with politics, with current events. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about how you see your role, and maybe we'll start with Jerry and then ask Norma the same question. How do you see your role as a writer, as a poet, as a nonfiction writer, as a fiction writer, in this ongoing conversation that we're having about so many of these issues, many of which are not new?
Mm-hmm. I don't really expect my writing to change the world. I'd like to think so, and if I became a bestseller, maybe it would have a little impact. That's not going to happen, I don't think. But I think that at least equally important to me are the other aspects of my life. The daily work of maintenance on our land, but also political engagement at every level, in the county, in the state, in the nation, and trying to be aware of the needs of real people and to, in our own small ways, address them as best we can. One example, Norm and I have both been involved with an organization called Sharing the Dream in Guatemala, which, as it happens, has a new store just up Phillips Avenue from the studio here, which I'd encourage everybody to visit. They sell products made in cooperatives in Guatemala, and those things sustain scores of families at a subsistence level. Beautiful work at a reasonable price that people depend upon for their livelihood, and it allows them to stay in Guatemala with their families on their land and still have a decent life, without which they might be among the refugees. So that sort of awareness, we've both been involved with Sharing the Dream in Guatemala. That's one example of, I think, the way people can be involved locally, but there are many other ways. I think what's incumbent upon all of us is to ask ourselves, what can we do in our own ways to help make the world a better place rather than to contribute to the horrible things that we see happening across the globe, from climate change to drivers of immigration to violence at every level and so on.
Mindfulness has become almost a catchphrase lately. There's, you know, people are talking about mindfulness in a variety of ways, but it strikes me that this is a way to express mindfulness is to say, paying attention to where you live, how you're heating your home, where you're shopping, when you see something, what are the things that we can do? You sort of live mindfully, even though you might not call it that. Yeah. Does that ring true to you?
Yes.
Well, with a sense of conscience and responsibility, realizing, I think, those responsibilities that you have to others and being grateful to them, being grateful to the migrants for their labor, being grateful to other countries for all the work people are doing to make and create the things that we enjoy in our country, rather than, you know, feeling that somehow not being out in the fields picking those berries, but instead in our cool, comfortable environment indoors, removed from nature is somehow superior, because I don't think it is. I mean, I think that we need to really think about that. Who's really doing the work that is sustaining us? And so I have some other poems in here that address that, I think, in my book, Frog Creek Road in particular. One of them, and I don't know if you have room for another poem or not, but if
poet's
you do,
choice, yeah.
I will read it if I can find it here. It's called Earth's Birthright. From the hilltop above my house, I survey snow-covered fields to the curve of Earth. As I walk back downhill, I feel the century-old cottonwoods embrace me. I belong to them, and my heart and soul are the same as this light blue sky with filmy clouds, the same as the sun shining from the east, the same as the hearts and souls of Muslims, Hindus, Mexicans, Palestinians, Jews, Buddhists, atheists, Christians, agnostics, pantheists who love our planet. On our prairie, my husband and I plant a garden each spring, yet we depend on others across this earth to grow and harvest most of the food we eat. Morning shines light on us and them. Light shines all we need and enough to share with our brothers and sisters everywhere. That's my poem expressing that idea and that feeling that I have, that you know, all of us are part of this great creation and need to realize that and share it.
Has that been part of your lives always? Is it, how has it changed over the decades? The things that you, the way you understood the world in your 20s, is it the way that you understand the world now, basically only with more richness? Or have you changed drastically? I mean, did you have awakenings of newness that sort of resonate now?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much the way I felt for a long, long time. I mean, it's just that once you become parents, that makes a difference too. And you see your children growing up, becoming adults and having their children. You become grandparents then, and you think maybe more, I don't know, of the future generations. Yeah. And
are you optimistic about the future?
Yeah, what else can you be? Otherwise, you know, pessimism is not really an option because it leads to inaction. Mm. You know, I grew up in a very remote area of Oklahoma, so I grew up in nature, and have always appreciated nature, but political awareness evolved much more slowly, and particularly, I guess, during the Vietnam War and my time in the Army, I really started thinking for myself, and it's a continual process of education, self-education, and thinking things through and not taking what politicians or anybody else tell you for granted. And as Norma says, we're all in this together. We have a commitment. We have a responsibility, particularly those of us who have blessed lives.
We're all in this together. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you That's for right. being here with us together on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
We thank really you so much.
Appreciate all thank that you do, all your books and all that you've done for SDPB over the past 3 years at least, and much longer, really. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Lori. It's been a pleasure.